Ted Corporal.
My name is Don, and I'm an alcoholic. And this here fella,
Tom Ivester, an alcoholic.
We're both members of Alcoholics Anonymous. In good standing today, we haven't had a drink.
Fix that.
Of alcohol. We've never done this before. Tom and I have never done this before. So we're in for an interesting day. We hope that you will also find something useful here, but we really don't much give a damn. We're in for an interesting day. Tom hit on it a little bit last night. I want to just lay a little bit of groundwork, because there is a tendency in any organization, and that includes this one, that once you find a method or a way, you lock in and everybody else is wrong. And we don't mean to do that, but that's just the way the human condition presents things. At our noblest, they're not wrong, but I'll give them the right to be wrong. They're not quite right yet either. I'm probably closer to this man than I am my own brother. In so many ways, it's hard to describe. We're kin. We have worked together both in AA and professionally. Our approaches are different, but they're the same. The easiest way I've been able to put it is that I came to the fellowship through the big book. Tom came to the big book through the fellowship. But it's the same thing, the same place. And one of the concerns I personally have with me doing this over and over is that it's wonderful while I'm here and you hear what I say, but you never hear what I say. And I come back and you tell me what I said. I didn't say that at all. So, and it's the same thing with individual sponsorship. We're all clear when we're in the room. But when one of us goes home, there's a shift on it. And that's just natural and normal and correct. One of the things that I would like to do this time, how many of you have been here in a room like this with me sitting in a chair running my mouth before? Haven't you heard me yet?
It's like your favorite song,
Don. I know. Yeah. See, I almost stopped doing these. I've been doing this for 30 years because this is what God called me to do. I have an ability to open my mouth and stuff comes out and people say, "Oh, that was wonderful." And I wonder, what the hell did I say? And if they don't say it's wonderful, at least they stay. The only time I know it's effective, that I'm being effective, there's two ways I can measure my effectiveness. Somebody gets up and leaves, or somebody goes to sleep. And if I can accomplish that, we'll have a good day. But let's say it, I don't know any more than you already know. Please know that. Probably less than some of you know. I have to keep going over it and over and over it. And this is rigorous. I got up at 3:30 yesterday morning and got on an airplane and went through the stuff you go through now with security. I caught the fact that my ticket said I was going to Washington, D.C., which is where my luggage went. And that's as far as it got. I managed to get here. There are some rigors involved. And then there's the rigorousness of sitting here. I know what I have to do. Tom knows what he has to do. You know what you have to do. So all of this compounds, and then I get tired of hearing the same thing. I only have one story. I have different approaches and different pieces of it. He and I have been around so long, there's a six-hour talk in each one of us, and that's just the beginning. So I've been living with a sense of where I am, God is, for 34 years. And that means every day of my life, something incredible has occurred. And I'm going to tell you about all of it. We just don't have that much time. Anyway, I was doing one of these things in New York probably 7 years ago or so. And I'm a believer of being right out front. There's no levels here. We're peers. So I will tell the new person exactly the same thing I'll tell him. And if he isn't around, you're going to get it. So, and I was talking to one of my spiritual daughters, Ruth. I told her, I'm getting ready to quit doing this. I was also just finishing up interferon treatment for hepatitis. That makes you tired. I just want it out. I'm a private person. My greatest joy is to just be by myself in my little room, looking at all the stuff I've got hanging on the wall and listening to Mozart. I like it. Anyway, I told Ruth, I really am thinking of not doing this anymore. She said, oh, don't stop. When you come, we all get together, and it's like having a grandpa or an uncle show up and tell us stories. And that's why I'm here this weekend. As long as that's all I have to do, we're going to be okay. In fact, I catch hell, and I know you do, for not telling some of the stories. Why didn't you talk about that one?
True.
I come from a family, an intact, functional family. I'm sorry, but I do. I'm the only alcoholic in it. We now have 5 generations in my family living on this planet. And there's no sign that my mother's giving up. She's finally gotten a cane, but my sister said that isn't so much for walking, it's that she's getting cranky. So be careful when she's got her cane in her hand. She has attitude. She has to wear hearing aids, and if she's sick of listening to you, she just turns them off. That's functional. But I never fit in that family. There's always that sense of alienation. I look like them, but that's because the space people who dropped me off were good modelers. Okay. I didn't feel like them. Didn't act like them. Good morning, Shelley. Y'all know Shelley? Now you do. She's from the old Denver Young People's Group. We were front pew sitters. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Tom talked about process last night. Part of the process is becoming a member of the family. Now, I see AA as a big family. But as in any family, there's kissing cousins and there's immediate family. And it's the same here in this spiritual family of ours. Immediate family are those folks that you kind of do the same things with. My brother's a professor of music at the University of Colorado and one of the foremost synthesizer musicians in the world. Just got back from Russia. They take him over there every year to teach in the summer. And I love him dearly, and I'm proud of him, and we're close. But we don't do much together. He has, in our talk when we put our lives back together, when I was making amends, he pointed out that he and I do the same thing. Our goals are the same. We are trying to touch people at a depth that is so deep that when we leave, they have been changed. That's what we're supposed to do here, you know. This isn't about just chatting with each other. This is about profound changes in people's lives that are so profound they don't even know they've been struck for 3 or 4 weeks. He says he makes his music the way he makes his music, and I make mine the way I make mine. But we're both just singing our song. We're co-owners of a cabin in the high country. I never go. That isn't how I do high country. That's how he does high country. But one of the ways I had to make amends is that he wanted that cabin so bad he could taste it. And I'm one of the three of the siblings. We all chipped in and got the cabin. Okay, I can use it anytime I want. I've got people I fish with, and I've got people I bowl with. And I need to pay close attention that I don't take my bowling partner fishing. It just doesn't work. We had, Jackie and I love Epcot. We go every couple of years. We're part of a group of people circulating a petition to ban children. They got their own place next door. So a couple years ago, we had occasion to make a big mistake and didn't know it at the time. Her sister and her husband and Jackie and I and some dear, dear friends from Lafayette, Louisiana, and some very close friends from Houston, Texas. The four of us went as couples down there. You know, you can get a villa for $1,000 a week, and when you split that up among four people, it's nothing. And we almost destroyed the friendships. Our rhythms are different. We like one another, but when I'm at Epcot, I don't want to be fooling around. I'm on a mission. And those damn Cajuns were just way too laid back for me. And I was just way too... Anyway, you hear what I'm trying to say? So our recovery process has some basis and truth in that. There are different ways of doing the same thing. And I must be... I'm a big book person because that I came to AA. They put me immediately into the big book. We did the steps, and then they immediately took me out of the big book and put me to work. In 5 weeks, we had completed the step work out of the big book. I personally had a series of spiritual awakenings. Not everybody in my same group did. I caught the fever. In the 6 week, they gave me the next group of people, and it was my job to sit there and do the same thing that had been done with me. And that's still how I do things. But let me read a piece from this, because it's kind of where I'd like to go with some of this weekend. I use this book because it's a guide. These are people who did certain things, made some bad mistakes and killed some folks, did some things right and other people lived, just like me. But in it they describe not my personality, not my style, but what do I look like? I get a guide here for doing the work. And please understand, I don't think working steps is doing the work. That's preparation for doing the work. The work here is to help others. So on page 18, and I looked it up, I don't memorize this. He tried to ask me if I was sure that was a page, and I'm sure because I looked at it yesterday. There's a description of when I'm through here, or if you're approaching me as a new person, this is kind of how I should look. The ex-problem drinker, that's me, who has found this solution, I have, who is properly armed with facts about himself, I am. See, I can check this off before I go trying to kill you. Can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. Tom hit on that last night. The process of finally identifying I am an alcoholic, I am one of these, can take a day or it can take months. And I have a young fellow that I'll tell you about that it took over a year before he felt this identification. So this is what I'm supposed to bring to the table. But the man who's making the approach has had the same difficulty, not been the same place. My first sponsor was doing a natural life sentence for a double murder he'd committed when he was 17 years old in a jewelry store robbery. That's high drama. I'm a sneak thief. I didn't do that. There's no way I could identify with that. Don't give me a gun. I know something about guns. If I have one and you have one, I might get shot. Okay. Me? No, I'll throw up on you. I won't see you. But he described the morning that that occurred. He told me what was going on in his head and in his emotional state. He said he woke up with the feeling that nobody cared whether he lived or died. And the pain of that was so great that he started drinking to kill the pain. You can't live with that pain. Only this morning it didn't kill the pain, it intensified the pain. And there's only one honest emotional response to feeling alienated and set apart. That's outrage. My spirit knows that as good as you are and as bad as I am, I'm as good as you are as bad as I am. I belong here, and I know that. So I get outraged. I create the loneliness, by the way. It doesn't look that way from in here, but that's where. And in that rage, he decided to hell with it. I'm going to go get mine. And he went down and robbed a jewelry store, and in a shootout with the police, killed some people on the street. 17 years old. So I could identify with, I've had the same difficulty. The drama doesn't define the alcoholism. I've met people in the penitentiary doing life sentences who are not alcoholic. They're just bad behaviors. I've met people who did crimes and weren't even drinking. In fact, I challenge you with this. I came in here thinking at one point I did what I did because I was drinking. No, most of the time I was drinking so I could go do what I did. Because in my sickness, I'm a moral coward. A lazy moral coward. I lived by principles all of my life. And my principles were, screw you. That's a principle. Get yours first. Otherwise, you won't get it. What I did to do that, of course, was get yours. I thought yours was mine. Anyway, that's... The man who's making the approach has had the same difficulty. I listened closely to this man. Did you listen closely? He kept coming back because of the spirit that was there. But the movement to where he's sitting here this morning came as a result of finally understanding, oh, you had the same difficulty. I may be weird, but so are you. Thank God. Same difficulty. Now, what are some of those difficulties? Drinking is not a difficulty for me. It's a way of life. It's something I will do. It's natural. From the first drink, it's natural. What are the difficulties that we have to face? How about getting out of bed in the morning? Tough one. Tough one. Because the minute I come out of the dream state, which is where I'd rather spend my time because I went in there. Okay. My mind never, ever stops. Ever. I've got a hunch with my mind that 3 weeks after I'm dead, it's still going to be working. Trying to figure out, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. So I wake up in the morning, and as I'm waking up, I realize I'm in trouble. I have to go to work. Oh, and I don't want to go to work because I don't like my job. It's beneath me. Or I don't know how to do it. Or I won't look good. Any number of 100 reasons shows up. I don't want to go. And if I do go, I'm going to be in trouble anyway. Because I'm going to be late. That damn old car of mine, I'm going to have trouble with it, and then the traffic's going to be, I'm going to be late. And my boss is going to give me hell early in the morning. I don't like him anyway. And I know me pretty good. I'm going to say something dumb and get fired. So why get out of bed? It sounds funny, but you're laughing because you've all done something. What are some of the other difficulties? I want to be a good father. I had one. Good one. Didn't always like him. In fact, a good part of my life I didn't like him. Which is kind of a shame because he was a good man. He went through changes. My dad and grandpa back in the late 20s and early 30s were the head of the Colorado Ku Klux Klan. So we had some kind of funky ideas in the house for a while. They both had spiritual awakenings and put the robes aside and spent the rest of their lives undoing some of that. I never took the robes off of them. That was part of the problem. That was the separation. I never took the robes off of them after they did. We do that to people. So I missed a good deal. But one of the things I remember about my dad, mostly, was that he was there. I didn't always like that, but he was there. I have a model of what I would like to be. I would like to be there for my kids and for my family. And what's my difficulty? I'm so obsessed with me, I can't be there. Even when I'm in a room with you, I'm somewhere else. And so you, as children do, you want my attention. You become an aggravation to me. I'm busy doing something else. Sitting quietly in this chair, doing something else. That's a difficulty. How do I overcome that? Well, first I have to identify with it. And we could go on and on. The man has the same difficulty. Big difficulty that's the same. When I start drinking, I can't seem to quit. I had to work around the idea that if when you want to stop entirely, you can't. It never occurred to me to ever stop entirely. I didn't even know I was alcoholic when I got here. One of the reasons I think God put me where He did is because immediately upon entering AA, I was taken to the description of what alcoholism is. Because I was certified as a sociopath type 2. Bad stuff. Don't know for sure what it is, but you don't want it. Federal man said I was a psychopath, and the doctor said I was a manic depressive drug addict. Because I had learned what keeps folks back. And that'll do it. You getting a little cramped because there's too many people around you? Throw a couple little mood swings. They'll back up. You got to get good at it. If you do it too much or too loudly, they'll put you in an institution. And if you don't do it quite enough, they just invite you to the parties because you're the entertainer. Same difficulty. I'm self-centered. I'm spending all my life in here. And this is what they're talking to me about so I can identify. And if I take a drink, I can't not take another drink. as we began to describe that, I found out why I went to the penitentiary when I was 19 years old. I took a drink in Long Beach, California on a 24-hour liberty. And what's described in this book as a phenomenon of craving, which is just a big word for I can't quit, the next drink becomes paramount to all other. Okay? And what a relief that was, because my sponsor helped me understand that doesn't mean you don't love your children or your family or yourself or any of that. It's just they are now second. Your body is craving something and your mind is craving something. David Huff, God bless him, fought that. I went in to have a couple beers. I just changed my mind. And we just let him keep saying it until he finally heard what he said. I changed my mind. My mind got changed. And he got it. And I could begin to identify with that. I'd missed some appointments because of the alcohol. Over a 14-year period, I also used a lot of speed and acid, but I'm not a drug addict, so we won't go into that. I'll just look at my alcoholism. Long before any drugs entered my life. It was 5 years of just drinking. The main reason I started using amphetamines is because it made drinking easier and possible again. See, drinking wore out for me. Same difficulty. I want to be like him. The human condition is a wonderful thing. When you find a newfound friend or a peer, you want to be just like him. What are you laughing at, Marcy? The problem is, we all have clay feet. I had good sponsors. He didn't want me to be like him. He wanted to be like me. He wanted me to be like me. Anyway, we made some identification with a number of people. There were three of them that I stayed close with, and I began to recognize something even then. There's some fakes in AA. Did you know that? Yeah. There's some people who sound really, really good. But if you watch how they live, you wonder, this doesn't quite match up. And I bitched about that once. I come from a line of sponsorship that says, if you don't like it, bitch about it. To me, so I can set you straight. Okay. He said, dummy, that was my name. Well, before I met you, I was 38,984. That's a pretty good leap up. Dummy. He said, it doesn't make the slightest bit of difference what anyone else is doing. What are you doing? That's clear. I'm bitching. Well, quit it. If I bring a new person to a meeting who's already confused and frightened and who's looking for something new, and it comes from an environment where the F word is every other word and where complaining about the state of life is the conversation piece and hate is the motivator and fear is the motivator, and if I bring them to a meeting and all you're doing is bitching and cussing, complaining about everybody else, why in the hell would he stay? I wouldn't. And I have to create that arena where that will occur only minimally. It's bound to occur. There's days when I've earned the right to bitch. In fact, I've reached an age, Tom, where I think I'm going to become cranky. And I'm not even going to have to work
at it. Very lonely.
Yeah. Yeah. I tried it for about 2 weeks, and you're right. But he obviously knows what he's talking about. I've been continuously sober since December 26th of 1967. That statement should tell you something. I know what I'm talking about when I say, simply, if you're alcoholic, you don't ever have to drink again. I can show you a way in which you can live a life that will make sense to you without alcohol. And I know what I'm talking about. And I hang around with guys who are 45. And Yale's 51 now. And, you know, if you want to see some examples, we know what we're talking about. Shelly, you're, what, 34? 33? Yeah. Well, we come from the old Denver Young People's Group. We were something to behold. About 15 of us.
15 of us. I was just
going to
say.
We had a meeting on Tuesday night. It was ours. You were welcome to come if you could stand the heat. You know, young people have confrontation meetings and work steps like their lives depended on it. And on Sunday night, we sponsored a meeting where the whole town was there at York Street. It was a call-up speaker meeting. Nobody knew who was going to chair until they walked in the door. And nobody knew who was going to speak until they got there. We thought that was pretty nifty, and it really was. Nobody had time to figure out what the hell they were going to talk about tonight. And the rest of the week, we went other places. We came to your meeting. We went to Greeley and Fort Collins and the north side of Denver and hospitals. We were a very busy, involved group. We met in homes back then, too. I can remember it clearly. We had an old dog, big old black dog. And we'd meet in our home, and the dog would just lay there. And the minute we started the Lord's Prayer, the tail would start. We did things together. We know what we're talking about. Can I meet that? Yeah, I can meet that. Not from here, but in my heart, I can tell you I've been married to the same woman for 25 years, living in the same house. I know what I'm talking about. Don't come to me with your relationship problems. I've never figured out how to help a healthy, sick relationship. So I can't do you any good. But if you don't know how to have a healthy relationship, I can show you how to have a relationship with God, and that'll translate into everything. Anyway. But his whole deportment shouts to the new prospect that he's a man with a real answer. People don't listen much to what we say. Words are good carriers, but because words in the English language, words mean so much, they don't mean much. So in order to overcome that, we have developed a storytelling way of presenting our message. I can show you a technique till it's running out your ears. I won't. I save that for the really sick ones that come to my house. Because it keeps them busy while we try to figure out how we're going to keep them alive for one more week. My deportment, that means how I conduct myself. If I sponsor you, you will show up at my house at 6 in the morning. Although there's a couple of guys since I've retired have pushed me to 7, but I like 6. A couple of reasons. When I was working, that was the only time I really had available. But mainly, I want you to see how a recovered alcoholic and his family prepares for the day. It's the toughest time in any alcoholic's life. We think it's the afternoon. No, it isn't. In afternoon, we're getting ready to drink. That's the easy time. It's this early morning stuff. And that's what was done for me. And I came out of the prison and had a little hotel room, and then I moved into a little apartment with the toilet down the hall, and then I finally got one that had the toilet in the same room again. Well, it had its own door, but it was in the same room. And I wanted to be a family man. So I picked a man to sponsor who not only had an answer technically, he had a family. And I just got in Gary's back pocket. And watched how he did that. And he wasn't very good at it. But he was better at it than I was. At least his kids talked to him. had a job. Let me tell you real wisdom from a sponsor, a big book fanatic, gave me this. Gave me two things. First of all, he said, are you tired of being arrested? And I said, yeah. He said, then quit going where there's cops. Oh, okay. Profound. He said, do you want money? I said, yeah. He said, well, get a job. Then once you've got it, show up for it. Kind of regularly. And on time, if possible. And while you're there, you might even consider doing some work. He's a smart mouth. And at the end of a given period of time, they'll give you money. And it'll never be enough. But it'll always be enough. Now, that'd be smart alecky if I hadn't been watching him. He had a job. Even in the penitentiary, he had a job. And he did that job. And he had another job, which was liaison with the administration so we could have our meetings. And he had another job, which was wandering the tiers talking to noodles like me. In fact, that's one of the things that brought me a step further in the process. When I was locked down at night, because this is an environment where if you're not doing something, they put you back in your cage, so they don't have to worry about you. And when I was in my cage, he would come by and visit with me. And I realized one day, he can't do that. Inmates are not allowed to wander the tiers. You're either on your job or you're in your cage. I want what he has. He's getting out of his cell whenever he wants to. I want what he has. And I finally got it. That was his main job, was going around talking to the people who were coming along in the process. In the school, we did this. The rest of the time, it was by example. His deportment, he was clean. You got two kinds of people in the prison in terms of dress. There's the ones that just have the clothes that go to the laundry and come back, and they look kind of shabby. We don't have very many tailors there. So. And then there's the players, and their clothes are always needle-sharp pressed. Avoid them. If you're not through drinking here, you'll end up in a penitentiary. Remember that one. Stay away from tightly pressed clothes people. He exhibited the same thing I'd seen in my dad. He was there. So I began by watching examples to understand one of the things that I must develop in me is to be there. My dad gave me a little piece of wisdom. Didn't come out of here, I'm sorry. It's in here, but you won't find it in these words. He said, Don, all a man needs is two things to live a good life, honor and wisdom. You need enough honor to keep every promise you ever make, despite the personal consequences, and enough wisdom not to make too many promises like that. It's a principle that suits me. It comes right out of here. If I get rid of all the self-interest and all those things that are going on in my head, and I keep making promises I can't keep because it makes you feel better, and it's the old con game. If I get rid of all that, I can just show up. I don't have to go through all that stuff in my head about, am I pleasing you or not? Don't much care. I know I won't do anything to displease you if I can help it, but if it does displease you, well, okay, talk to me about it then. And then get the hell away from me. I think so. He was always there. Not at my beck and call, but he was always there. Somehow he showed up just when he needed to show up. He was always there. And he was available. That's another aspect of being there. He was available. Folks who know me know that I'm very easy to reach. If you need me, There's an awful lot of people who say they can never reach me. Well, it's because they don't need me. Okay. Is that esoteric, Tom?
Probably emotional.
Yeah. So I'm watching. I'm beginning to develop, I guess you could call them skills, to develop internal, they're not even principles, they're not intellectual things, ways of being. If I give you my word, I will keep it. Know that. That's where I stand. Don't ask me for my word unless you intend for me to keep it. Because I will. And if you don't really want it, we got conflict. But he has no attitude of holier than thou. Today that concerns me, I must tell you the truth. Lots and lots of places I go have a holier than thou attitude. Some of it comes from people who use the big book, and some of it comes from the action folks, and some of it comes from the who cares folks. Holier than thou. My effectiveness is the fact that I know I am you and you are me. That was my big spiritual awakening. How can I be holier than you are? Sit around and listen to the war stories. And it's not the high drama stuff. It's the really chicken shit stuff, like stealing a kid's piggy bank because you need a drink. And I know that, and I can project that. And I don't come down to your level, and I don't raise you to my level. We meet where we are. And that's good enough for me. I expect the very best out of everybody I meet. I also know that whatever you brought to the table today, that's your very best. Okay? I'm not going to make any judgments on that. Nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful. Can I fit that? Or do I have an agenda? If I decided that you should be in your fourth step in your sixth week, if I have, I'm not matching this. You need to tell me how to work the steps. I don't need to tell you. The pacing is different for everybody. And I need to be... Talk quickly about Chuck. Chuck softened me. I was a big book fanatic of the kind that got rigid for a while. If you weren't doing it exactly this way, you weren't doing it right. And, I cherish those days. I don't want to ever return to them. Oh, horse's ass. And God sent me Chuck. 5'2", mean as a snake, dangerous. So dangerous when he walked in the room, didn't even have to say anything. People just backed up. It was clear, this one would eat you alive if you said the wrong thing. And not even use a toothpick afterwards, just bad to the bone. He'd been sober 8 years, worked at Hazleton and drank. Had several 2-year periods of sobriety, and then he drank. And he was done, and he was trying to drink himself to death and couldn't, and that made him even madder. So they sent him over to our group in Denver. When you got one that you just can't do anything with, send him to us. I think it's probably revenge. Anyway, Chuck got right up in my face. He'd been told to talk to me. Got right up in my face. Just dared me to say anything meaningful. And he said, and don't give me that big book crap. I've tried that and it didn't work. What am I going to say? He tried it. It didn't work. And I love that because then I pray, which means I get into a state where I understand, I don't know what to say to this guy. Either put some words in my mouth or get me the hell out of here. And I heard it come out. I said, well, Chuck, what do you think of God? Oh, I hate the son of a bitch. I understand that someday we each get a couple minutes with him and I can't wait for my turn. Tell him what I think of this shitty deal. And I'm going to hell with my friends. And I thought, good. He believes. We have an attitude problem. But he believes. This man was so deeply wounded by life and by alcoholism. And by life, I mean he came up in a family. He was wounded. This was a wounded animal. And I knew that there's no way I can do anything except nurse this guy if he'll let me. And I did the only thing he needed. He needed a friend first. He needed to feel somebody on this planet cares about me, even though I hate everybody. So I just had him come by my house every day, and I was in a business that I traveled around town, and he just rode around with me, spewing hate. I don't care. That just goes right on through. There's nothing to worry about there. Almost a year before we could do anything except ride around. The change occurred in Chuck because of my wife, not me. We stopped by the house one day and she'd made chocolate chip cookies. And she gave us each one. They're really good, by the way. And Chuck ate his and said, "That was good." Which to a cookie maker means, "Well, here, have a bag." And we got back in the car and he broke my heart because he described his condition to me. He said, "Why would she give me a bag of cookies?" I was able to say, "It's because she thinks you're a member of the family, Chuck." And I watched the change take place. Then we could get into clearing it away. Okay? There's no fees to pay. I'm going to challenge you on that one. I'm sorry. I go to a lot of meetings where right in the middle of somebody's talk, which is very rude, somebody starts passing a basket. With no explanation whatsoever. And I got into a new guy's head one day, watching that happen, and thought, wait a minute now. I'm new here. I'm still shaking. I've got 57 cents in my pocket. Some other idiot has told me make 90 meetings in 90 days. That's a setup. I'm sorry, I don't believe in that. You should make far more than that. Don't put a number on people who can't show up anyway, for God's sake. And that becomes a target. Anyway, I'm listening to you and I'm watching you because I'm suspicious. I've tried a lot of stuff and nothing's working. I've probably tried this four or five times and it didn't work either. And right in the middle of someone sharing something, they start this basket around. No explanation. And I'm watching the people go into their pockets and come up with a buck and throw it in the basket. I got 57 cents. And I'm going to be here for 90 days. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that this thing's going to cost me 90 bucks. And I got 57 cents in my pocket. And I might not eat tonight. I probably won't come back here. So maybe a little explanation would be appropriate after the person finishes sharing. No fees to pay. Our Denver Young People's Group, we used to tell them, if you're new, don't put anything in that basket. You're not a member yet.
We used to tell them to take it if they needed it.
Yeah, we quit that, though. No axes to grind. I'm sorry, I try to live up to that one, and I just don't do well. Grinding axes is one of the few pleasures I have left. But I'll try not. I'm not going to grind them with new people. No people to please. If I sponsor you, you do not have to please me. You don't have to do a damn thing, I say. If you don't, you won't get the results that you came to me for. But you don't have to please me. You do have to show up on time, regularly. If you don't, then you don't have that time anymore. I just assume you don't want it, that's all. I don't fire people. I get fired a lot. And that's good, because it clears the deck for somebody new. But you don't have to please me. You don't have to dress a certain way. You don't even have to clean your mouth up to please me. please me. I will suggest you may want to do that if you want to make any friends somewhere along the way. Well, they did that for us. It was suggested by my sponsor that I learn to speak English instead of street. And if you're getting into corrections work, please don't try to talk contact. You'll know right off the bat you're fake. And they're not going to listen to the thing you say. And you're not very good at it. They are. We get tested a lot with that one. No lectures to be endured. Oh, God, save me from that. I love lecturing. One of the ways that I finally gained the trust of my children is that I stopped raising them. I think raising children, the way most of us do it, is a criminal activity. It's an imposition of my values on you, and you will, by God, reflect well on me. Okay. And you do that by lecturing. Remember when you were a kid and all the lectures you got? I don't remember any of the lectures. I just remember all those of God. Because the minute you start that, click. These are the conditions we found most effective. And there was the second piece, that I was to become effective in my life. I just tripped through. Most alcoholics have that. We really want to be effective. I want to know that somewhere along the way, my being on this planet counted for something. That I wasn't just another number that went through here. That somewhere somebody can say, don't remember exactly who it was, but this happened and my life changed a little bit. It got better. I think we all want that. I've got to be effective, not right. That was the way it was put to me. Learn to be effective, not right. Get you out of the debating society. None of us makes a sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. That kept me out of the treatment business for a lot of years. I got back into it, but in a different role. I applied for a job 3 years sober with Joe Wright out at Fort Logan, his house father. We practiced as amateurs, now I was going to be a pro. She said, honey, you can do this job very easily, but if you do, you'll lose some of what you've got. So I did not take the job. I want to be effective. Effective as a parent. What does that mean? What is an effective parent? I'm not going to define it for you. I just want you to think about it. I can see the results of effective parenting. When my 2-year-old grandson comes in the house, he gets a big grin and he runs at me and almost knocks me over. I've done something effective. He trusts me. Yeah. Anyway, we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our various, in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. The implication is that I will have each of those things. A home, an occupation, and affairs. I just have to be careful not to have more affairs than I have principles. This is, I'm going to let Tom talk now. This was just the introduction. Sorry it took so long. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our various respective occupations, homes, and affairs. How can I take what's in here out here? Because if it stays in here and I stay in here with it, I'm useless. I'm of no use to anybody. How can I take this out so even people whose methods may be different, whose style may be different, we can work in brotherly and harmonious action? That's what this is really all about. How do you do it on the job? I've got some stories later about how that plays out. Spiritual lives are very real right now on the street. Let's get with it, life. Meditation is important. Inventory is important. A business that takes no regular inventory will soon go broke. A business that stays in inventory all the time is also going to go broke. You got to be open for business every now and then.
Notice I didn't pass the basket while you were talking.
I appreciate that. If you'll excuse me, I'm not running out on you.
Yes, you are.
But I'm old.
I know. Old people have duties. It's 10 o'clock. Let me get logistically solid here. 9 o'clock, what time do we break to eat those sandwiches you made? Eat at 10:30?
No, just a break. Like a 5 minute.
Yeah, I mean the lunch deal.
Oh, that's at 12.
At 12 o'clock. Noon o'clock.
12 to 1:30.
Okay. That sounds like a square deal. So we'll break by 10:30. All right, good. Yeah, I like to do that. Yeah, I like to sort of puts me at ease. Well, it also helps me know what I'm doing. Sometimes people just turn you loose and say, do whatever you want, just be wonderful, you know. I won't rehash it all, but let me just piggyback a little bit what Don was talking about. You know, this chapter, there is a solution, is what we're about. And it's about how we make this solution come alive. How do we make the solution really be a solution and be effective? A lot of times when I first looked at the big book, it looked like just jumble to me. You know, it just looked like a whole bunch of philosophical stuff. But what I find when I get into it is that it's about as detailed a manual as you'll ever see, in terms of laying out in specific kinds of terms, how we make these things happen, and that very much is true to me. I appreciate what Don was sharing. That I was thinking that I think probably the most uncomfortable I have ever been trying to talk to an AA group. A guy asked me to speak in Charlotte, and he was a lawyer. I mean, that doesn't excuse everything, but it explains a lot. And the guy had gotten hold of my professional resume from somewhere. And he introduced me to an AA group by my professional resume. And I swear to God, I have never felt more awkward in a meeting in my life. How do you get from that to what we're about? And I bet you it took me 10 minutes to get reoriented and reintroduced to a way that we're on the same sheet of music. And what that does, it came to mind when he was talking about this, that unless we get those essential ingredients for making the solution come alive in place, it doesn't happen. You ever go to a meeting and somebody lectures to you, somebody just makes a speech? That has to be a classic demonstration of how to turn off somebody. I mean, drunks won't listen to that. They absolutely won't listen. I don't care how good it is. It just doesn't have the ingredients that earn the confidence of an alcoholic. We had a really wonderful person come speak at our group a while back. And they spent the first 30 minutes just launching into an abstract presentation of history. History's interesting if it's coming from a drunk. But if it's a history lesson, you can thump it up. And so for 30 minutes, everybody was kind of restlessly shifting around and politely listening. And then, half hour into it, they got drunk and started talking about drinking and wrestling and throwing up and rowdy behavior. And my God, the crowd just became electric, you know. And some of that, when that's not in place, it just doesn't work. So we get some brain dead sometimes listening to drunk stories. But thank God for them, because they're the heart and soul of the Henry. You need this. Don't you go too far away. They're the heart and soul of this thing, of what it is that earns the trust and confidence. Because if you hadn't been there, I don't particularly want to hear the philosophy unless you're coming from the same place that I'm coming from. And so, yeah, to me, that's awfully important, this ex-problem drinker, that if I can establish the fact that that's who I am, you know, that I'm a guy who has had this problem, then everything I offer is valid. You know? And the same with you. If you're telling me something and I know where you're coming from. Now, I learned a long time ago that, you know, alcoholics don't invest real trust very readily. It's got to be on the basis of a proven relationship, a trusting relationship. But once it happens, it never stops. It never quits. Because it's a lifetime deal. I'm constantly amazed at how many people I have called me that I worked with 20 or 25 years ago. And there's something about that connection that occurs that just becomes almost like a sacred trust. And when you start getting shaky and unsure, you want to reach back to something that you trust. You want to get something that you know you can hold on to. And so I think it's an awfully vital thing about the solution, that it's not enough just to have a lot of glib words that describe something. Very important for me to understand that it's based on my experience. This thing of one alcoholic honestly sharing their experience with another alcoholic has had effectiveness like nothing this world has ever known. And that's why I share with Don this notion that if we start moving it into a technology and we get too studious in it, we lose the spirit of what this dude's about. So tremendously important to me to always keep in good, sharp focus that my experience is what's valuable, not my wisdom or wit or all that stuff, but it's the experience. And first and foremost, and then who's found a solution, pretty important to be able to have a valid story of recovery and not just a drunk story. So pretty sharp criteria for that. Armed with facts about himself, not about the illness, about the sociology of Alcoholics Anonymous, but armed with facts about himself. And then it comes from a good, solid, confident kind of a place. Get to earn the entire confidence in just a few hours. The other thing I just wanted to mention a little bit, that it's the thing about the holier than thou. And that is a kind of a sneaky thing. And subtle things kind of make that happen. It's the thing of, you know, I see us sort of collectively doing it sometimes. Well, let me go back to a prison thing and then branch that out just a little bit. Some people, when they do institutional work, get into sort of group thinking. You know, group thinking. Put everybody in one box. And one of the things that I used to really dislike in those early days were people who would come in and talk about you guys like there's one monolithic set of people sitting in these chairs. And my God, it's all different people. You know, they're totally different people. But it's sort of looking at folks as a class. And I don't know of a less engaging thing that you can do, because there's no connection. That's just sort of a kind of a useful class action stuff, I guess. But it happens. And folks will tend to sort of lecture and advise people that they see as a same group. And so it really works against this business of earning trust and confidence in me. When I can't get away from this kind of separation of seeing myself in one category and seeing you in another. Very important for me to recognize it, that we is us. I see it also in some of the ways we deal with people who come into our meetings who are sort of like, for example, people who come in with a court paper. And we'll tend to deal with those people as if they were one thing. and sort of write them off as people who are in a different category because they happen to have a different hook in them. Okay? And we'll tend to just sort of routinize how we deal with them and miss the opportunity to really relate to them as individuals. Now, one of the real challenges that I've been trying to work on and been trying to enlist others into doing it too is how we deal with people who come into AA, and I think it comes under that holier thou, even though we may not be thinking that way consciously. Like if people come in to meetings from a facility. I was speaking somewhere the other day, and three people got up and left at a certain time. Well, I mean, I've been around long enough to recognize the behavior. I knew they were reporting somewhere because it wasn't, you know, like random acts of desertion. I mean, this was like somebody rung a bell, you know. So I kind of leaned over to the guy beside me. I said, "Where are they going?" He said, "Oh, they come over from the jail, and they have to be back." Yeah. But see, it was compartmentalized thinking. Yeah, and those folks came in as a unit, sat as a unit, left as a unit, and never really shared the experience the same way those of us did who were sitting there. And so thinking of that, whether you're thinking holier than thou or just that these folks are different, absolutely blocks the thing of connecting and earning the confidence and trust of people. Treatment centers, same thing. I don't know about here, but a lot of our treatment centers have waned and not as evident. But people from halfway houses and treatment centers has been a real perplexing concern for me. That they tend to operate like, I guarantee you, I could go to a Jaywalkers, and if people were coming in from a facility, I could spot them, and so could you. Because you watch them, they'll move like they're in a cube. You know, they'll come in sort of cubed up on a bus or a van or something, and then they'll march like soldiers into the meeting, and then they'll sit together. And some of it is regimentation. Some of it is just the thing that's where they feel safe, I guess, or something the other. But I've seen people, I've watched them walk into the meeting in the cube, sit in the cube, move into whatever group they're going as a cube, get back on the bus as a cube, and never interact with the folk in the meeting. You know, they're subtle things, but they're ways that we display this kind of sort of put it under holier than thou, this thing of not breaking through those barriers in the ways that we can. And if we don't get past that and get it to a personal level, I'll give you one other example of a thing I ran into. And part of what got me troubled about court papers, I was in a city out in the Midwest a while back, and there was a meeting that I don't go to a lot of daytime meetings, but they had a noon meeting at this particular place, and I said, "Well, shoot, I think I'm going to catch that." So I went in, and I was kind of like the psychiatrist at the burlesque show. I was watching the audience, you know. I mean, the meeting was fine, but I got interested because they had a deal there where the secretary of the meeting sat on a raised platform at a desk and sort of ran the show, thought she was, and nobody paid attention to her. But I started watching the people who came in with papers where somebody had mandated them to be there to get a signature. And they had a ritual. When you came in, you went up to that desk and you put the paper in the inbox on the desk and sit down. So I picked a guy just to sort of see what happened. I picked a guy who walked in, random selection, came in, put his paper there, just like he was trained to do it. I don't know if he teach it on the street or what, but he just came right in, put the paper in, went down, sat down about in the middle of the crowd. Meeting was on step five, and I kind of watched him the whole meeting. And he was, you know, I didn't disrupt anything, he was just properly attentive. Got through with the meeting, got up, walked up to the desk, got his piece of paper, walked out, never interacted with one human. Now, we would put him under the heading of having been to AA. Has he ever been to AA?
No.
He came in and observed a meeting. He didn't engage in a meeting. Got into no fellowship, got into no conversation, not got into no personal interaction with a single human. And to me, that's that thing that happens when we start thinking collectively of people, that we just kind of write off a whole class. And we don't use it. We don't want to be ugly with that, but it's just something we do. So just mention that thing of thinking collectively of people. I tell you one thing I ran into when I don't know. Time goes so fast when I'm talking. I got time for this one little war story that kind of makes the example. When I got out of the institution and went back to Michigan on my first trip, I was going to the state convention in Lansing, Michigan. And I had a lot of buddies. I hadn't been back since I'd left up there. And I had a lot of dear friends that I wanted to see. I started in the hotel, and there was a real nice-looking guy standing there with his name tag on. Well-dressed fellow, looked like a Wall Street guy. But he had the name tag, so I knew he was a drinker. Went over, chatted with him for a minute, and then I asked for a guy, and he recognized the guy that I mentioned as doing a lot of work down at the institution I was in. And he said, you must have met Pete. Were you around Jackson? I said, yeah, I was there. He said, well, Pete does an awful lot of good work down there. He speaks you fellows' language. Well, now I know that was a mild, innocuous statement. But it's also the kind of statement that can drive you out of here. And I said, could I ask you what language is that? He said, oh, you know what I mean. I said, yeah, I do know what you mean. But I hope you know what I mean. Because I speak the same language you do. I don't speak a foreign language because I happen to be in a different setting. You know, they're simple things, you know. And I wasn't being scornful of the guy. But it's very important because that attitude can be the barrier to somebody coming here. So when we're looking at things about what makes the solution come alive, what makes it effective, I think that's why the book points out this kind of thing, is that those little attitudes can make the difference. You know, if you have that kind of feeling about somebody, you don't need to tell the new guy. Guarantee you, his feelings are out there sharply enough that he'll pick it up. You can't hide it. And so I think it's awfully important that in doing that, it's kind of like Don was saying, it's not so much how much I know or how glib I am or anything like that. It's about how well I can present myself to the person and earn that trust and confidence. If I don't, the rest of it's an exercise of futility. How long do we break? About 10 minutes. I noticed the way she said it. 10 is never means 10 minutes.